KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This weekend, it's 10:04.
So being that it's Friday, the end of the week, we like to review the news of the week. And on weekday on KUOW Seattle, I'm Steve Scheer, joined in the studio with Knut Berger, the Mossback columnist at crosscut.com, blogging at Seattle Magazine, author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Good to see you again, sir.
Good to see you, Steve.
Also with us, Lynn Varner, editorial writer and columnist for the Seattle Times. Very nice to see you again.
Good to see you.
And Josh Feit, editor of Publicola. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you. Good morning.
I thought we would start with a little musical interlude. As you probably have been following, and as we talked about with Interim Chief Pugel earlier, in 1986, the Seattle Police did a training video, as they called it, wherein the police officers, in a very well-produced video, I may say, dressed up as homeless officers, other officers dressed as police, and they did a version of Under the Boardwalk they called Under the Viaduct. Here's a little bit of their song.
Under the viaduct, where dirt is our floor. Under the viaduct, who could ask for more? Under the viaduct, we'll be drinking our booze. Under the viaduct, our sores continue to ooze. Under the viaduct, viaduct. Take us off to jail. A sympathetic judge says, don't you worry about your bail. And it's back to the viaduct, down by the bay.
Some nice singing, I think you would all agree. Some very nice singing in that. Chief Pugel was here, said it was embarrassing, apologized for it, said it was in bad taste. The police department at the time in 1986 recognized it as bad taste. And when the police chief at the time, Patrick Fitzsimons, saw it, he reprimanded all those people involved. And as Jim Pugel said, it's been brought up every time he goes for advancement. They destroyed all the copies but one, because apparently even when you have incriminating evidence, you save some of it. So we're in the midst of a big deal with what is happening with the Seattle Police Department, the Department of Justice. This may blow over, but what is it? Where are we? What's your initial reaction when you saw? Were you watching TV last night? Where did you first hear about it, Knut?
No, I saw it online. I saw Seattle Times had the link, and I mean, just kind of roll your eyes. Jim Pugel has apologized. I think he. It's probably devastating to any hopes he might have of.
Do you think that?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think it's hard to get over, and I think it's hard even with whatever apologies he makes and well-meaning effort. I think it's just going to be hard to get over the image. I thought when you were interviewing Pugel in the last hour, I thought you made a good point, which is. When you see humor from people in power that's punching down, it's not the same as punching up when John Stewart or somebody does it. So I think there when you're dealing with these issues of the kind of cultural bias in the police department and whatnot, I just think it's really problematic in terms of I mean, we were kind of talking.
27 years. I wouldn't want any videotapes.
It happened a long time ago. He's been very, forthright about talking to people about it, getting, making sure it was released, and facing up to it as he's say owning it. And I think that's really good. And I'm also glad that I don't have to explain everything I did or said in the 1980s.
But Knut, I think it's more than just one guy. It's the culture of the department and the fact that this happened, that people were fine with it. He didn't have any lack of participants who were willing to be in the video. It's that culture. It's that sense of indifference that people in the community think the police department exhibits toward him. And it's one of the reasons why the Times editorial board said that they ought to look for the next chief from outside the department, not from within.
Was that before? That was before.
Yes. Oh, yes. But this just further cements our view that they got to find fresh new eyes.
I agree with that. Also, by the way, I mean, I felt that even before this, that they really have to do a national search. They have to go outside.
You think 27 years later, there's a thread we can trace?
Right, because that's exactly it. It's just a thread, and there are many more threads in that kind of rotten fabric that just needs to be.
Is it rotten to you?
It's in need of just some fresh
stitching.
Leadership. Yeah, fresh stitching.
To keep our metaphors.
Continue that metaphor.
I mean, the problem is we sit here and we kind of talk about this distance back to 1986, but Lynn's quite right. It connects, resonates, makes sense with all the recent incidents we've seen in the past year, 2 years, 3 years. So in some ways, there's not even a difference. So, I mean, again, we can say, you know, I wouldn't want to be accountable for things I did and said in the 1980s, but I don't see how. I mean, it just, this is yet another kind of incident that fits right in with where we are. So there is a thread, and it does sort of lead you to the conclusion, I agree with Knut, that Pugel's political chances are shot and that there needs to be real emphasis on a change in culture. And I think all the mayoral candidates are sort of talking about that.
Yeah, I think if you did a tape back then and it came out and people saw it as anachronistic, you would be okay. But when people look at it and say, that confirms my worst suspicion about what's going on, that's where I think the real trouble is.
Yeah, there's nothing to balance it with. There's no new, fresh a difference in the department. I mean, there's a lot of ongoing training. You're going to see a lot of improvement, especially with the DOJ oversight, but not enough that now people would balance the video with new reforms and say, oh, no, that's the old department.
And a new person would do that because they're going to come with their baggage of their police departments. So why do we think a new person has, I'm just going to return to your image, better sewing skills?
I don't think Pugel and I don't think the current chief had the gravitas or the independence to turn around and face the people within their department and say, this is about change and the buck stops with me.
And look, when you're looking for a new chief, you can certainly do interviewing and vetting and get someone that comes from a system that we can applaud. We saw that we tried to get the guy from California, but that didn't work. So I don't think it's a matter of all police officers come with this kind of baggage. So and essentially, I mean, you know, we're one of a few cities that are under DOJ oversight. And so there's clearly something going on here.
You know, we are going to see the first report coming out from the monitor, maybe today, maybe later today or soon. It sounds from what we hear, it sounds like though not all in agreement, they are working together on these reforms. When you hear, however, I'm going to take you back to just one thing that was in the Seattle Times article. As Jim Pugel said, as a police department, we have much work to do to strengthen our relationship in the community, something that means addressing an ugly piece of our history head on. That was one of his reasons for putting it out. But he also said that, and he said he didn't remember the entire quote, but this is the paragraph that was written. Pugel, while repeatedly saying he did not condone the video or his participation in it, said the media tips, because there were tips that this existed and which is maybe one of the reasons that police got out in front of it, point to, quote, pockets of resistance, end quote, in the SPD who he believes are trying to undermine his role in implementing court order department reforms. Have you heard that, any of you in your reporting or in discussions, that there is what I termed pushback to some of the reforms that might be coming? Anything either official or unofficial from any of you?
I haven't heard that, but look at the union's resistance. And I think that the chief's decision to leave was partly helped by his relationship or lack thereof with the union.
That they weren't going to be cooperative.
Or not in the way that he wanted them to.
Yeah. Does the discussion, you guys had this story, and it was in a few other places too, the discussion about the police guild, head of the police guild is paid by the city through this interesting contractual arrangement. Can we see this as part of the negotiations here that's going on between officers and the monitor, if negotiations are the right word, about who's going to be responsible, who's going to have authority as we move forward, as the DOJ imposed monitor starts to be felt by the officers?
I mean, I think the thing that you can that the DOJ oversight helps with is, I mean, this has been a roller coaster for years now, right? This kind of this intractable issue of police accountability that runs into the guild negotiations. And you kind of had money trade-offs for accountability trade-offs. The city, when it doesn't have a lot of money, can't get a lot of accountability, et cetera. What the DOJ oversight does, and I think is one of the biggest political stories in the past couple of years in Seattle, is mom and dad finally showed up. And so you have a new – which I think the public just wanted. A similar thing happened, I think, and a completely different story. Mom and dad showed up in the McCleary decision. I mean, these are two things that have rankled our region for a while. And so I think ultimately these kind of questions you're asking, Steve, about negotiations between where does accountability and where does the union fit in, that's why the DOJ stepped in. And at this point, I think the pushback is going to be more difficult for the union to win on with the DOJ in the room. And, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know ultimately how that plays out in court, but the DOJ is a heavy player.
They are a heavy player. You agree with that?
Yeah. And there's clearly been, even before all this, a power struggle going on. And, I think that the publicity this week about the city paying the union salary of the head of the police guild, I think is a real bad PR for the guild, certainly. It was interesting. I posted a link to it on Facebook, and I was amazed at how many people weighed in saying, I am pro-union. I'm outraged by this. I don't think the city should be paying this guy's salary. It doesn't do this for any of the other unions, and people were really upset. And I think
– imagine if the public paid the teachers' union.
I was about to say that, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just
– Well, some people would say they do.
They do, sure. And maybe they do.
I'm a little suspicious about the timing, though, and maybe you two can address that. It just seemed kind of interesting that suddenly now this became known, and I wonder if the city wasn't getting the upper hand by saying –
Yeah,
it's a sweetheart deal. You might not enjoy it much longer.
Exactly. It's probably part of the
– That's what I mean. We're seeing the public jockeying of some things that are happening behind the scenes.
We also have to remember that all of this is happening in the context of election year for mayor. And I think one of the problems that Pugel has politically is trying to imagine whoever the two nominees for mayor are defending that video. The new mayor is going to have to appoint the new chief with the approval of the city council. Imagine these guys trying to defend that. I just don't see it as politically.
It's just not. You're right.
Tenable.
It's hard to imagine.
And I think the police really run a risk of appearing to be too resistant, and it may be that Pugel is caught in the middle in terms of the substance, but he's really hurt himself with being honest about this thing.
But it is interesting that there clearly must have been something going on with tips. I think, didn't you guys report that you had received tips mm-hmm. about the video? Did anybody else? Did you guys? But so there was somebody out there knew it existed and wanted to see it released, hence the police moving first to release it.
And having the impact that it has had.
Yeah, then no matter who releases it. It has that impact, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, now we get to wait for the monitor's report and the appointment of a new head of the Office of Professional Accountability, which is supposed to be announced imminently, we heard from Chief Pugel. So that, after a long time, the current OPA director has been sort of on hold because she's been doing the job even though she announced her resignation. There will be a new person announced. And we'll see what that means for the police, too.
And we should wait and see what happens on May Day.
And there's that. Now, they say they're ready, Lynn, but of course, serendipity is a producer and serendipity marches in the street, too. Do you have what's your feeling? What's your confidence level? We heard a report that said the police weren't ready last time. The police have responded. They said lines of communication are better. Who's in charge is better. Trying to work with the merchants to protect their buildings better. But as we learn, if somebody wants to do damage, it can be done.
I would say they're more ready than they were last time, but certainly I'll be watching.
Yeah. Where do you work? Where's your office?
We're downtown on Western.
You'll be watching.
Yeah.
You'll be right there.
I'll come down the hill.
Yeah. Josh Veit is here. So is Kunit Berger. So is Lynn Varner. We'll take a break. We'll talk about some of the other news of the week on Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Hello, this is Dave Beck. KUOW is grateful to everyone who participated in our recent spring membership drive. Now it's time to close our books. So if you've mailed in your pledge payment, thank you very much. If not, please send in your payment today. And thanks for supporting Public Radio, KUOW.
Yes, thanks from all of us. 54 degrees in Seattle under a clearing sky, expecting some sun this afternoon and a high of 68. Overnight, it's going to cloud up and then there's a chance of rain this weekend.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, providing a variety of fresh organic fruits and vegetables, now introducing the Paleo Box for adherence to the Paleolithic lifestyle approach to eating. Local delivery available from Zarly.com. More information at Zarly, Zarly.com/Tiny's Organic.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1021.
I'm Steve Scherer. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle with Kunit Berger, Lynn Varner of the Seattle Times, Josh Veit, editor of Publicola. Say, we're going to head down to Olympia Way with you, Josh, because I know you've been covering this. And I wanted to start with just one of the news stories that came out of Olympia. And here's a lovely way to do it. We got this sound. We usually play the sound of the week at the beginning, at the end of the last hour, but we wanted to play it this time. Here's the sound we got for the sound of the week. That's the sound of force carbonating two corny kegs of beer with CO2. That's what it sounds like. Listener John and Gabe sent that sound in. They were kegging a homemade amber ale for Gabe's wife's birthday party. Sound was made at night in the mostly dark on the back deck. Now, he might not have had to worry about that brewer tax. But if he were going to try to sell it, he might have had to worry about that. But now he doesn't.
He does not.
How was it that those folks were out in front of getting the governor and legislature's effort to keep and even increase the beer tax killed?
I mean, I think Rep. Reuven Carlisle, who heads a finance committee, the House Finance Committee, who, you know, had the proposal for lower the beer tax,
but
bring in microbrew, correct.
Yeah.
He said it best when he was asked that question. He said, you know, they're going to turn around and write a big check to Tim Iman, and this just complicates things. And so, I mean, ultimately, the power of money speaks. They admitted it in Olympia that this is a very, very wealthy industry. This is the same industry that helped pass Tim Iman's initiative last time. They clearly saw it coming as well. The two-thirds, you know, putting in $110,000, they're going to do it again. So I think it's that simple.
And that means I would expect that the carbonated beverage industry is right behind them. Isn't there still a tax being proposed for bottled water, rather?
Bottled water, sure.
Bottled water, yeah.
They're putting that tax in there. And, yeah, I mean, Tim Iman, who has a new initiative out, you know, he said it – who has a new initiative about raising taxes that he filed this week. You know, he said it best. He said, look, whatever tax they pass, that's who's going to fund my initiative. That's what he said to me this week. So there is going to be a resistance, but the House did this week pass for the first time. They did something that Democrats have been saying. I mean, they come through your editorial offices. They promise it every year. We're going to get rid of these tax exemptions. They never do it. And this time they passed $400 million worth in getting rid of tax exemptions. They got a majority of votes to do that, which is no easy task. They sent it over to the Senate. Rep. Ross Hunter, who's the appropriations chair of the House, has a real kind of bargaining chip now. He can say, to the Senate majority, the Republican-dominated majority coalition caucus, he can say, I've got 50 votes for this. So that was a huge lift that the House Democrats pulled this week.
Which are the most, to you, surprising tax ending of tax loopholes or extending of taxes that did go over to the state?
I mean, they're all hard. You have every tax break exemption that has a constituency. Obviously, not all as powerful as the beer industry. I don't know. There was an interesting debate over the out of state sales tax, and they actually ended up tweaking that one a bit so that out of state shoppers could get a rebate. And there's a debate over who pays that tax. Actually, you can make the argument that actually it's not really Clark County so much as the majority of those taxes often come from Seattle, and it's Seattle that would be paying that be footing that exemption, the removal of that exemption. The bottled water one is one that is interesting. But I think they did get rid of the most controversial one, which is the beer tax, because that just comes up all the time, and it seems like a tax on the working class. And the interesting thing about the beer money is, that tax, beer taxes are in play, of course, because of all this DOI legislation. Where are we going to get the money to ratchet up these rules and incarcerate more people? And Senator Adam Klein has talked about the beer tax for that.
Yeah,
well, let's
circle back around. Is the whole question of the DUI, but just to stick with taxes, did you watch some of the exemptions that made it through?
I did not,
and didn't.
I didn't.
Do you think that? So I will not make you list them. Do you think that we are seeing some power here? You're sort of alluding to the fact that maybe the House exhibited a little power as this work goes to the Senate.
Absolutely.
Do you see those that Senate coalition?
Look, what Josh said. I mean, it's very encouraging when the legislature ever ratchets back those loopholes, because they never do. So it's such a rare instance, and it'll be interesting to see what the Senate does.
Sorry, footnote that I forgot to say is that in fact at the committee level, in the Finance Committee, when they were discussing this, the minority Republicans on that committee had amendments. I mean, like 30 amendments, basically forcing the Democrats to justify each one. You'll notice they failed. They did not bring that fight to the floor. So at some level, flipping the camera on this, yes, there's kind of a constituency for each tax exemption. But the fact that the Republicans didn't have this kind of PR fight on the floor and do the hey, you guys are job killers and you're raising taxes, which is how the Republicans frame ending these exemptions. Because I think the Democratic frame has been, hey, it's either you're going to get rid of tax exemptions for out-of-state sales tax. You're going to get rid of taxes. The biggest one is probably big oil, right? There's a tax exemption there for extracted oil products worth $41 million that big oil companies get. Do the Republicans want to have that fight on the floor when the Democrats can say, okay, do you want to give a big break to big oil, or do you want to fund K-12 education? And I think what you hear the Democrats saying is, we're happy to have that fight. And the Republicans didn't have it on the floor.
So that – go ahead, Lynn, and then I'll follow up.
Representative Carlisle also promised a periodic review of all of these different exemptions. And I think that also spoke to the minority, the Republicans, because it says that every couple of years you'll have a chance to review these, let them fall or rise on their own merit, as opposed to just doing away with them forever or raising –
Is that in the legislation?
Well, I don't know. That's what I was about to ask.
Actually, ironically, that's a bill from the very popular Senator Rodney Tom. He has the kind of it is a Reuven Carlisle,
yeah,
something Reuven Carlisle has been pushing. But Senator Rodney Tom is the one who has the official bill on kind of adding accountability to tax exemptions. That is using the hip word metrics. They want to put metrics in place so that the legislature can actually have a sense of how to judge these things. Now, interestingly, knowing that Rodney Tom has kind of corralled the Republicans in the Senate behind him, the House Republicans voted against that in committee, just, I think, to take a stand against the entire package. So kind of just an ideological position against this revenue package, they voted against that.
Seems like an odd stand to take.
Absolutely odd, because the Republicans wanted that, at least the ones in the Senate.
Well, Senator Tom is the one who proposed it.
Do you want to weigh in before I go on to education?
Well, yeah, this is on taxes, and I just noticed that the House and Senate negotiators had come to an agreement on a transportation bill that they say is probably going to get passed on Sunday. And it has a lot of kind of – it's not the big grand thing. It's the housekeeping sort of bill in terms of various – and one of the things I noticed is they've agreed to spend more money studying shifting from the gas tax to per mileage charge. You know, as a matter of state policy, this is now something they're really seriously exploring. And as the gas tax becomes kind of more problematic in terms of increases, they're looking at alternatives. How do we get out of the gas tax thing? I thought that was really interesting. I saw they also were looking at extending the good to go pass system, having that system run the ferry systems, ticketing and reservation system. And the good to go thing has been really problematic, at least certainly on 520 it has been. With a lot of stuff. So my eyebrows were kind of raised. But anyway, I just thought it was quite interesting that they're also putting a lot more money into tolling. They see that.
To study it or to implement it?
No, to actually they're beefing up tolling capacity and making the improvements they need to do in that department. So, you know, those people, and we've been talking about this for years, you know, tolling and mileage taxes are in the future. They're also in the budget.
Yeah, well, the House is really using tolling as leverage. They know that the Republicans in the Senate have been against that. But Rodney Tom, again, 520 is his big project. And ultimately, if they're going to complete this project, they're going to need tolling. And Representative Jamie Peterson from Seattle got an amendment into the House transportation bill that said they couldn't move forward until they identified Seattle funding, which means tolling. And so since Rodney Tom is so wedded to that, it's a clever way of getting tolling on the agenda. They also proposed adding a tax as a threat, a 3-cent tax that if they don't get tolling, then that's the issue. So tolling is definitely in the mix.
And of course, we're talking about tolling other than 520.
That's right.
I-90 or the corridors or something. By the way, that housekeeping transportation bill that then did not include any final decision on the bridge over the Columbia, is that right? They're still
hunting on that? They're still working on that, I believe.
I believe fighting on that. Would be more appropriate.
Yeah.
I want to come back to the question of education on this. Do you see anything that looks like a real education funding package that you've been looking at, Lynn, coming out of Olympia? I mean, we see the proposals, but now we're starting to see the outlines
You're starting to see the outlines of a package that's going to resemble more what the House Democrats proposed, a lot more revenue. It was kind of interesting, this session, because both sides just were basically racing each other to see who could write out the bigger check. The House, of course, won. But what is going to happen in the next few days is a lot of horse trading. So it may seem like the Senate Republicans were a little stingy. They were putting somewhere around $500 million less into education than the House. But part of that was about reforms, not just money. And so you're going to start seeing the House looking at some of the reforms and talking about those as they get the Senate to agree on the money, because it is going to be new revenue.
Were there reforms that you thought were being discussed that you thought were effective reforms from your perspective? Somebody's covered this for a long time.
One of the biggest is to continue to fund teacher and principal evaluations. There's a whole new system now. It's much more robust and stronger, but it's also expensive. It takes a lot of time, and it's currently in pilots. And the legislation that was passed last session makes it statewide, 296 school districts. So both the Senate and the House are funding that. That's a good thing. Senator Steve Lizzo in the Senate has some great proposals around accountability, in particular discipline. We've seen all the studies that say that low-income and minority kids are disciplined at higher rates. But why? The state really hasn't paid attention to that. They don't even keep good data on it. So he's got a bill that the House likes. And so that's going to probably get through. There's a real controversial proposal about grades for schools. you know, you give kids A, B, C, D. Well, why don't you give schools that? It seems to be a pretty simplistic thing that covers a real huge complex issue. What do schools do and how well do they do it? But it's a promising start. The governor has said that he likes the idea, the concept of evaluating schools and giving them a grade that parents can understand. But he's not totally there yet with Lidzo. But I think that that's going to happen too. So in addition to the money, and again, the money is going to be closer to what the House is proposing, which is like $1.2 billion. But in addition to that, I think there are going to be some smart reforms coming out of the Senate.
And in terms of that money, again, I know you're tracking that too, Josh Feit. This is where, with this package, it looks like new money, because the Republicans did not want to bring in new money when they first started talking about this. It looks like there's going to be some new money from these revenue enhancements, tax breaks and loopholes being changed. I think do they ever use the word tax in there?
They don't. They do a lot of what they've been criticized for, of shifting money from other accounts, some gimmicks. They take money from a school construction account, which actually the appropriations chair in the House says is unconstitutional, because they'd have to say that we're using up all the money to build schools and we haven't built schools. So, but I did want to tack on one thing on this reform question. There are a number of reform bills, and the Senate Republicans, including Senator Steve Lietzau, have made them kind of go home bills, that they're not going to get a deal unless they do these reforms. Other ones include, holding third graders back, a principal consent bill on the principal must agree to take a teacher that is being sort of shuffled around. But a really key one that people aren't talking about, that is also, there's not getting as much press attention, a go home bill, they're calling it a reform bill, is something that the Senate under the Republicans passed last week or early this week or late last week, which is a cap on non-education spending. That is sort of tacking to revenue growth that you can, and it works out if, you know, new revenues come in, anything 6% above that, you can only spend on education. You can't spend. And this bill, is really controversial in terms of liberals and Democrats and social service advocates who say that that is just forcing the legislature's hand, that the formula they're using, while it tracks to population growth and inflation, it does not track to caseload growth, which is how they currently track. Maintaining service at the current levels. So this bill, and I'm surprised it hasn't gotten that much attention, but it is one that is going to be a real poison pill in these budget negotiations, because I've heard from Lietzau, people like Senator Lietzau, that this is a go-home reform for them.
Isn't that the sort of McKenna?
It is
approach.
Exactly the McKenna approach.
Right.
And, I asked Governor Inslee about what he thought of this this week, exactly because of that, Knut, because it was his opponent's proposal. And, what Inslee said was, hey, the way to fund schools is to fund schools, not through what he called demagoguing and dramatic political statements, which is how he characterized this bill.
But getting some control over the other areas of the budget, so the non-education portions of the budget, is important. And caseloads do go up and down. Last session, they actually found savings because DSHS caseloads went down and there were fewer kids in K-12, so they actually saved money. And another biennium, they may actually have to spend more money. So the scary thing about that piece of legislation is that it ignores the up and down nature of some of the spending outside of education. On the other hand, though, they do need, if they're going to spend more on education, and the Supreme Court has said they have to, and the court retains jurisdiction, which means they can come back and say, okay, we weren't being clear. Here's how much you need to spend, and you need to do it now. Well, if they don't want that to happen, then they do have to get a hold on the other parts of the budget outside of education. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How has, give me your grade, let's grade Governor Inslee here as this session starts to move into probably a special session?
Yeah, I think that's going to happen. I think he started off pretty slow, and I think if you talk to people down there, people felt like there was a learning curve at the beginning. He made kind of a budget announcement early in the session and kind of landed with a thud. However, I'd say in the last couple of weeks, he has, He's taken a real strong hand, and he's actually angered the Republicans. He, after the House Democrats passed that revenue package this week, he went back there, and he went to congratulate the House. The Republicans complained that he was taking sides, and he told them, "Hey, I'm not wearing a striped shirt. I.e., I'm not the referee. I'm on the field." So he's making it very clear where he is. At the top of the session, the Republicans were trying to kind of keep him in their corner because he had pledged no new taxes. I think started slow. He really seems to be finding his footing now.
All right.
Well, he's not finding his footing in education. And I didn't
really. In what
way? No concrete vision or proposals. And I think that's what he's got to do. He's got to lead. He's got to tell the legislature, here's what I think needs to happen from early learning to college level. You all are going to do the policy, but here's my vision. And I didn't expect him to have it initially because Congress doesn't really deal with education that often. So I knew that he was coming in at a deficit. But now he still doesn't have a chief education person. Mary Alice Huschel, who was a former superintendent of the Renton School District, is his chief of staff, not his education policy person, although she seems to be doing double duty. But that's a really important area of public attention, but also the budget. He needs to get more on top of that.
You know, I disagree. His budget added a billion on top of the maintenance levels. The Democrats added 1.3. The Republicans added 900. So the education funding question is top of everyone's mind. I think Inslee, you know, this week he outlined his own go home issues, which was gun control, which was the Reproductive Parity Act, which was the transportation package that is funded, which is this DUI legislation, and to have a governor kind of. That's new to really just kind of step in at the end of the session and say, hey, here are my priorities, and kind of criticizing the legislature for not dealing with gun control and eloquently making the case that they have to. I mean, I thought that was new from the governor's office. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, the Republicans have even said, isn't it great that we're fighting about how much more to fund education? So, I mean, the education funding, which is new for the Republicans, it is top of everybody's mind, and Inslee is bringing in other issues that he's leading on.
And maybe it's because he knows those issues better, and so that's fine. Go for what you know. But it's easy to spend money in education. That's not the problem.
You want reforms. You want to see the other aspect of this discussed.
Right, because if spending money solved the problem, well, the education budget actually goes up every biennium. So if spending money were the answer, we would already be seeing results.
All right, let me take a break on that note. And let me just say, in going out, George Jones, who, as we talked about earlier, the great George Jones, even John Prine recognizes where he comes from. Definitive country singer of the last half century. He passed away, so a little taste of George Jones. He stopped loving her today.
He stopped loving her. A place to rip all his gold. And soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her.
The late country music superstar George Jones. We'll have a remembrance of his life and music later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which begins at 3 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Blue Homes, a builder of modern-designed, precision-built homes, who is hosting a tour of a glide house on Vashon Island on April 27th and 28th from noon to 4 p.m. Directions and more at bluhomes.com/Vashon.
54 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 68 this afternoon, and it's going to wind up partly sunny. Cloudy overnight with a low of 46. Tomorrow, Saturday, breezy. Cloudy with a chance of rain and a high of 61.
Support for KUOW comes from LeMay, America's Car Museum, which celebrates its first anniversary with a June 1st gala. The evening features musical entertainment, cars, catering by El Gaucho, and a preview of the new Legends of NASCAR exhibit. Details at lemaymuseum.org.
It's 10:43. Those air traffic controller furloughs that have been getting the blame for flight delays this week will be coming to an end. That's in our NPR News at 11 o'clock.
All right, we are reviewing the news of the week, saying goodbye to George Jones. I always get lucky with you. There's another one. And talking about the news of the week, we're talking about what happened in Olympia, talking about Seattle police. Let's take a little trip over to Texas, shall we? And remember George Bush. So George W. Bush's presidential library opened in Dallas yesterday. During his speech, he touched on a familiar theme.
The political winds blow left and right. Polls rise and fall. Supporters come and go. But in the end, leaders are defined by the convictions they hold. And my deepest conviction, the guiding principle of the administration, is that the United States of America must strive to expand the reach of freedom.
So George Bush talking yesterday at a dedication of his library. Opens May 1st. All five living presidents were on hand. They like to have those five presidents come together in their club, including President Obama. Here's what he had to say.
To know the man is to like the man. Because he's comfortable in his own skin. He knows who he is. He doesn't put on any pretenses. He takes his job seriously, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. He is a good man. But we also know something about George Bush, the leader. As we walk through this library, obviously we're reminded of the incredible strength and resolve that came through that bullhorn as he stood amid the rubble and the ruins of Ground Zero, promising to deliver justice to those who had sought to destroy our way of life.
So there's President Obama. It seems more Americans are changing their views of Bush's presidency. According to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, George W. Bush's approval ratings now stand at 47%. That's compared to 33% when he left office. Presidential historian Kenneth Davis is author of the Don't Know Much About Books series.
I'm quite surprised that in just 5 years, without any really major developments in the Bush legacy, if we can call it that at this early date, that there has been this spike. It seems a little bit fast and a little bit surprising. But again, when you're that low, there's really only one way to go.
Fast and surprising. It's Kenneth Davis. George Jones, George Bush, who would you want to be on a desert island with?
Well, you know, I approve of the fact that George W. Bush is an ex-president, so I suppose my approval rating of him has gone up. I mean, the United States has dementia, and it's actually kind of part of our system. We have very forgiving bankruptcy laws. We have we're very forgiving of people who screw up big time. And we have very short memories. And my suspicion is that the economy has partly to do with this, that people have, you know, they're not blaming him for the bad economy, but they're looking back and remembering kind of before the Wall Street collapse and that kind of thing. And certainly maybe the Boston Marathon bombing reminds people that the war on terror wasn't imagined. I mean, that there are threats out there that Bush responded to. But, you know, it's just really hard to hear the kind of, you know, papering over of the damage that I think George W. Bush did to this country. And I think that will be borne out in history.
You know, according to my news source, The Daily Show, when you are confronted in the museum where you make decisions, pressing buttons in the library, if you don't go after Saddam Hussein and lead him standing, George Bush comes on the air and said, no, you made the wrong choice. You are leaving a dictator in power that should not be left in power. George Bush rehabilitated a little bit for you, Josh?
He has not rehabilitated for me personally. I wasn't polled, I guess.
Well, you're the 53%.
Knut hits on it. The irony here is that the Congress and the president have been wrestling with this recession and these budgeting problems, and these are all a direct result of that Bush era and that crash. So I don't quite get the psychology of transferring those problems and not connecting them back to George Bush and sort of, I guess, in some ways exonerating. I don't know if exonerating is too strong a word, but obviously forgetting his culpability, which is weird. Right? I guess your word dementia hits on it.
I wrestled with this week on our opinion page blog, Opinion Northwest, and I guess time does heal all wounds or most of them. I think that people now, with some time past, look back and say about the war on terror, well, he was wrong to invade Iraq, but Knut's right. We didn't imagine this. There really is a threat out there, and this president has to deal with it just as the last one does, and maybe we shouldn't be so judgmental. But I also thought that President Obama said a couple of things yesterday that resonated, and that was things that President Bush spent more money on AIDS and malaria vaccines in developing nations than the previous president. And that's like, wow, you know, President Clinton was the one who actually, you know, has been at the forefront of that battle. So he did some good things. He pushed on immigration reform, not winning on that, but making it easier now for Bush to pick up that same baton. Obama to pick up that same baton.
Jeb Bush, I think you meant.
So he did something. So I think that what people, that poll to me said that people are balancing, that they're putting his presidency into some context that works for them personally.
You know, there is a juxtaposition with Obama last week that was interesting to me, is that Obama went to great lengths, I think, during the Boston, during the manhunt and all that, and after the bombings, to really speak entirely differently than George Bush had. There was a real emphasis on a lack of rush to judgment. I thought that his language was very measured that first day. We need to find out who did this and why they did it. The quote that a lot of people pulled was the weight of American justice. But if you actually listen to his whole statement, it was so much more measured. And I actually think that was a direct reaction to what people felt about the Bush era, that there was a kind of an unbridled jingoism that led to profiling and that led to division. I thought Obama took care to strike a different note. He also, you'll notice, ran into trouble during the arrests when people were reminded of the Bush era policies with the lack of the reading of the Miranda rights, which actually was an Obama compromise. It was actually watered down version of what the way the Bush administration had played it. But it still kind of jumped into the headlines and made people uncomfortable that, hey, what are we doing here? So that kind of, when you see those kind of policy reactions to the Bush legacy, as opposed to just asking someone, do you miss the old president? But when you see how people govern now, maybe people actually aren't as comfortable with what George Bush's legacy is.
That's exactly right. What have we learned from Bush's presidency? And one of them was that we were not going to charge this guy as an enemy combatant.
One of the great things about presidential records and libraries is that it over time, as more and more of the records open up to the general public and to scholars, more and more stuff comes out about how decisions and policy were really made. And so, you know, these things have resulted in the, you know, fabulous biography, multi-volume Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. You have the Nixon tapes, which every year they're the gift they keep on giving, you know. We find out some more horrible thing Nixon said.
About the viaduct. I think Nixon was dancing under the viaduct.
it is important for scholarship. And you know, there's a lot of the Bush presidency that's not history. As you guys were pointing out, it's part of what we wrestle with in daily life. The legacy, I think, of what a lot of what was broken during his years are things that will take decades to repair, even if they can be repaired. But I also think that the presidential libraries in general are a tremendous resource over time to get to that judgment of history.
I was struck by, since you talked about juxtapositions, just two, one being that now there will be, I'm sure there'll be hearings at some point about what the FBI and the CIA knew and why they didn't respond to the Russian threats and when did they know it and why did the Obama administration not respond soon enough. And secondly, throughout this week, the fact, and talk about dealing with it, the fact that the Guantanamo inmates are on a hunger strike and some are being force-fed, all repercussions from the Bush era as well. May I I want to take a moment here, and let's see if we can do it in one fell swoop. We had the council decide on what South Lake Union might look like. We have your article and people thinking about, Knut, what actually is Seattle Center's purpose in this city and how we should see it historically and moving into the future. And then we had this notion being proposed by Chris Hansen and being pushed by others that what would really be cool in if we built that basketball arena would be a whole sort of Staples Center stadium district down there. And I have a lot of people going, don't we have that with Pioneer Square? Don't we have that neighborhood now? But I think there's this sort of three things going on in the core of the city that could be reshaping the city. And I wonder if, are they connected? Are they linked in some way?
Well, they are. And the one thing you didn't mention was the reopening of the refurbished King Street Station, which is actually very important to the transportation hub that they're creating in Pioneer Square, Soto International District.
Didn't our friends at The Stranger call it a wedding cake?
Yeah. It's fabulous, but it's right in the heart of a lot of the changes that you're talking about. So many parts of the city are on the drawing board right now, in the sense that we're looking at them and there's a tremendous growth and change in those neighborhoods and opportunities for changing them dramatically. So South Lake Union, Soto, and the Seattle Center, I mean, they're all connected in that way. They have different issues. I mean, some overlap, but in South Lake Union, we saw the compromise legislation passed regarding the fees that would be charged to developers, allowing them to go higher in exchange for affordable housing units. And a debate was had on that, and a compromise was reached that it's going to produce maybe something like 700 what's called, I guess, affordable, which means 80%,
45,000
of median.
Yeah. Making 40,000.
There was an attempt to make it 60, and that failed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not cheap housing, but it's better than nothing but expensive condos.
If it gets built.
If it in fact gets built, and that's of course one of the things they're trying to frame down there, which is this balance between getting a public benefit for the growth. That helps people with things, a key issue like affordability, and not dampening the development market for that area and have all those people say, well, heck with that, let's go to Bellevue or some other place to develop. And you've got that balancing act going on in Soto, which is the balancing act between adding another stadium to the stadium district, the arena, but then all of that produces because that produces an impact on the whole neighborhood. And if it's turned into a big entertainment district, that does exactly what the port and others have been afraid of.
I thought Danny Westneat's column where he walked down there and just what we all should be doing, right? He walked down there and talked to all those little manufacturers who are cranking out little products as a laboratory was just a reminder that it's a very vital area and things are really happening there. You get the last word.
Oh, boy. Well, that's a lot of issues. I think
tie them all together.
Two quick things. I think the issue of this entertainment district calls into question for me something that's bothered me about this stadium district all along, which is we're building it in the wrong place. The idea that you just have this kind of single use in the evening for 42 games a year in this one place is just complete, seems to me, not efficient. And what you want to do is you want to build your stadiums in kind of a vibrant place, which is why Key Arena was where it was at the time. And so I think that highlights that. One thing I think is odd about this South Lake Union discussion, and Knut said, we want there to be a public benefit. Isn't there a public benefit by building this density? Isn't that what all the mayoral candidates are talking about? So I ask, why are we taxing people to do what it is that we want them to do?
You can just leave that thought there.
Good point.
All right. Josh Veit, Lynn Varner, Knut Berger, I thank you very much. In the next 5 months, I'll just have to call you guys up for coffee and have these conversations, right?
That's right. We'll miss you, Steve.
Yeah. Well, I'll still be listening. I appreciate it.
When do you?
Next week, I'm just out of here. I'm just going to be drinking coffee and, wandering.
coffee.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Wandering in my robe.
Counting flowers on the
wall. So you guys have to come down. Okay, so we're in South Lake Union.
You hold that thought. Because I just have to say this, Lynn Varner. I just say this is Weekday on KUOW.
President Obama is praising Planned Parenthood and criticizing new abortion laws. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Washington State chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. Social workers provide crisis intervention, housing for the homeless, hospice care, and family counseling. More information online at nasw-wa.org.
This week on This American Life, music lessons. David Sedaris recalls how as a boy, he took guitar lessons from a man who hated children. Sarah Vowell explains how she ended up in symphony band, jazz band, pep band, band one, marching band, orchestra, and the ever-popular Bozeman Recorder Ensemble, where the median age was 50 years old. And Anne Lamott provides much-needed moral uplift to our program. That's Music Lessons this week on This American Life, Public Radio International.
That's exactly 24 hours from now, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to producing safe, healthy milk that starts with maternity programs with pure feed and fresh water for healthy baby cows. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.